You've probably heard of Johnny Appleseed. He was a real person, famous even in his lifetime. Born around the same time as our country, he wandered around Pennsylvania and Indiana and Illinois while much of those areas were still being settled, handing out religious tracts, giving away even his shoes, and, you know this part, apple seeds. Seedlings, actually. He's seriously responsible for much of the spread of apples in early America, a benefit we're still enjoying today, and a few of us are even keeping up that work. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we're talking apples with one of Johnny Appleseed's distant relatives, who, believe it or not, now has an orchard down in Gardner, Kansas. Rick Godsell, good morning.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here. How exactly are you related to Johnny Appleseed?
He never had any children.
Okay.
So it would have been a great-great-great-great
uncle.
Famously,
he had never married, never had children.
Yes.
But he's some distant cousin now.
Yeah, the Chapmans are in the family line.
All right. Well, very good. Maybe it was just destined to be. How did you come to own or to live on an orchard?
Well, my grandma has an orchard still in existence outside of Macomb, Illinois. And our ancestors up the other side of the family founded Peoria.
Okay.
And it started with an orchard.
Wow, you have some historic stock in your
yes.
lines. So you came to Gardner how then?
Well, we moved from Illinois to Iowa, then to Olathe in 1984, and I bought the piece of land that we're on now in 99. It was simply a hay field, but I bought it because the California-Oregon Trail crosses the property.
Wow, and so it wasn't always an orchard.
No, it was an orchard in the 1800s, and all the trees were gone, replaced with basically a hayfield and a cattle lot. And so we planted over 1,000 trees by hand over the last 20 years.
Now, is this what you do for a living?
No, it doesn't pay the bills.
So planting 1,000 trees by hand when it's not what you do for a living, where does that come from?
It's an extreme hobby. I've got four kids, and I just thought it would be a fantastic way to grow up. I have really fond memories of going out and picking apples and making cider with my grandparents and my family. I thought it'd be a nice thing to have for my kids.
Now, how much space does 1,000 apple trees take up?
Well, a lot of people would think that's really huge, but an acre is about the size of a football field, and mm-hmm. you can easily get 250 on an acre. So we have a pond and barns and parking lot, outbuildings, and so it's not completely apple trees.
What do you call it?
Wagon wheel orchard.
Very good. So how do you know it had an orchard on it in the 1800s?
I went and researched the old plat maps, and it actually had the hand-drawn orchard to the north of the property, which is very common because it helped block the wind and the snow from your house. So in the Midwest, you'll see trees planted normally on the north side of the houses for that reason.
So talk to me about what it's like to have and own an orchard. Like, what's a year in the life of an orchard?
If we start January, there's not much to do other than graft trees and keep them in a cooler. We keep them in a deep freeze set at 36 degrees to plant in the spring.
Now, you're talking to a city kid here, so even grafting isn't obvious to me what that means.
Well, you're basically splicing the tree that you want to a rootstock that's going to end up being the size of tree you want. So you can actually have a dwarf tree, semi-dwarf, or full standard tree, which would go up to 50 foot tall. Probably not good for the backyard.
Right.
And nobody likes going up a 50-foot ladder. So
hard to get the apples. Yeah.
It is. So the most common that people go for is varieties that end up being about 12 to 15 foot tall.
And you're splicing a branch of the kind of apple you want onto a different tree's trunk.
Exactly. Yeah. And the most common ones that we do is called M111, and we end up with about a 15 to 18 foot tree, which you can pick with those extendable poles with the baskets on the end.
From the ground.
So your insurance agent is going to like that. You're not climbing the big ladders.
I grew up in Washington State, and I saw some of the giant harvesting machines that sort of come up under the tree and like just give it a good shake, and the apples bounce down into the
Yeah, truck. There's some pretty scary equipment out there. Because some of those trees, the trunks are 20 inches around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you pick all yours by hand.
We do. We do. You pick in the fall. So it goes from the grafting in the spring and pruning, and then there's a nice gap in the summer where there's nothing to do but mow. And then September, October, maybe into November, depends on the year, we're picking.
These are the busy times we're about to get to here.
Yes, so we'll do appointments on the weekends as we can, and sometimes we'll do school groups during the week if we can pull that off.
So do you end up, basically other people pick all your apples for you?
Yeah, that's the nice thing about it. what I've always found interesting is you go into the grocery store and you'll see apples for $2.99 a pound, and people buy them without thinking about it.
Yeah.
But when they come out to do you pick, they want to pay 50 cents a pound.
Right. And you've worked a lot harder than those people in the grocery store.
I could pick them and take them to the grocery store and sell them for $3 a pound. But the whole idea behind what we do is you get to go out with your family. You get to get family photos of you doing something that really means something. And it's a rare thing these days. There's not many orchards around.
And what is it that it means?
Well, if you did it every year, just think of the neat family album you can have of picking these, taking them home, getting grandma's recipes out, making a pie that's not, you know, not modern, maybe lard lard's in there somewhere, you know, stuff that tastes fantastic. So for me, it just reminds me of all those family memories with grandma and, you know.
Yeah. You mentioned those $2.99 a pound apples in the grocery store, which generally are all the same size and shape and often very shiny. You brought in some apples here this morning that do not look necessarily like the kind in the grocery store.
No, these are no-spray apples. This is a variety called Stamen Wine Sap, and Joseph Stamen was a local guy in Leavenworth. But when you don't spray an apple, it's not going to look like the grocery store stuff. And if you go to an orchard that does commercial, regular, conventional spraying, the apples look like that they've been on a dusty gravel road. And that's actually just the chemicals, the white powder all over.
Wow.
But ours don't have anything at all on them. You can eat them right off the tree.
And do they taste the same as the apples in the grocery store?
No, not at all. Those are going to be irrigated, sprayed, and they thin them chemically with 7-Dust about... Oh, maybe June, and it knocks off about 50% of the apples, and the remaining ones swell up abnormally to what you see in the store.
Hmm. So what you're getting in the natural orchards, the no-spray orchards, is a different flavor, and you'd say it's a better one.
Yes. Take, for example, Golden Delicious. If you get it at the store, it's going to be almost mushy. So is Red Delicious. They're both pretty bad in the store. Overwatered, no taste, and they probably weren't ripened on the tree. They were ripened by hitting them with ethylene gas to change the color.
Mm. And so, but they sure look great.
They do look great. Red Delicious is an example of an apple gone bad. That has a fantastic story. Jesse Hyatt in Peru, Iowa, found this tree growing, and he was a Quaker. Mm. And so he talked almost Shakespearean. And his story was that he kept mowing this thing over and over and over again. And he finally say, "If thou must live, thou mayest." And then So the original tree has been grafted several times, and we go up.
Like there is an actual tree that all Red Delicious apples started with.
It was really called Hawkeye Delicious, the Hawkeye State. Mm-hmm. And it tasted fantastic. It wasn't completely red, but it was kind of yellow-red. And over the years, they've bred it to look good, to not bruise, to last a long time in storage, but it's tasteless. It's horrible. Mm. And that's not what we have. We have stuff that just amazing.
I mean, I've read that there are a lot fewer varieties of apple in the United States than there used to be.
Yeah. There's a gentleman named Philip Reagan that wrote a book in 1909, and he stated 20,000 varieties were named. And it's called The Nomenclature of the Apple. And now we think it's more like 2,000 of the ones that were in there. There's more modern things like Honeycrisp and stuff that mm-hmm. were within the last few decades.
Because people are making new ones.
They are. Universities especially. If you came up with the next Honeycrisp, you'd be a millionaire. Because you're going to have a plant patent on that thing for about 30 years.
Wow.
You're going to get $1.25 per tree planted everywhere.
Wow.
So it's well worth it. So these research places are trying to come up with the next big thing.
So these apples you brought in, apples that grow on your – how many varieties do you have in your orchard?
We have over 1,000.
Wow. So how many trees?
It's not many more
than
1,000.
You started with 1,000, but you...
Yeah, we have about 1,000 in the actual orchard that are ages where they could produce, and then we have a nursery with about 1,000 more.
And you were telling me that there are different kinds of orchards. You're not growing to get the maximum number of possible apples for resale.
No, we're growing for preservation, so we graft and sell trees to collectors every spring. And some of the varieties that are available are just astounding. We have apples that are red on the inside. Yeah. And you'll probably see that in the grocery stores here in the next 20, 30 years.
Red on the inside. That doesn't seem right to me.
It's a little weird. There's one called Hidden Rose that's yellow on the outside, red on the inside. And when little kids bite into them, sometimes they think their gums are bleeding
right,
or something.
It would scare me.
It does. But the schools are now planting those to try to find something that tastes good, because the red gene comes from the crab apple, which isn't the best tasting. Mm. But they've been breeding them to be sweeter and tastier, and that's what you'll see is next big thing in the store.
Well, and I've read that Johnny Appleseed, a lot of the apple saplings that he distributed, that didn't taste good at all, but they still work for cider.
Well, cider in the old days was booze. they didn't trust the water. So he was making his favorite variety was a French variety that tended to grow similar to its parent from the seed, which isn't normal. It was called Rambour Franc. And he planted those, and they changed the name to Rambo. But the last remaining tree that was one of his was in Canton, Ohio. And we have grafts from that tree, and that one did survive.
So you've got some actual Johnny Appleseed trees.
Yes.
Represented in your garden.
Yeah. Clones.
Yeah. Yeah. So that is interesting, something you just said, that the seed from the apple doesn't actually produce the apple that the seed came from.
No, the seed really is the female part, and we don't know where the pollen came from. The bees travel up to a mile, so you could be a half crab apple, half Honeycrisp, and taste horrible. Mm. You really don't know until you plant it, and you only have a 1 in 10,000 chance that a seedling is going to taste better than the parent.
Wow.
So these schools are planting 50,000 trees in the hopes of just getting one that's marketable.
And it's somebody's job to taste those 10,000 apples.
Yeah, well, they eliminate growth habits if it's not going to do well in the nursery. That cuts out 9 out of the 10,000, and then you start going to letting them fruit.
Okay, so your obsession with apples now is obviously taking place on many levels. There's historical, there's the agricultural part of growing mm-hmm. them. Do you actually like apples?
I do. It's one of those things where if you have apple pie every day for 20 years, you tend to want to try a pear.
Uh-huh. So you like them, but not all the time.
I'm on a pear kick right now.
Okay, that's fair. Are you growing pears?
Yes, we have dozens of pear varieties as well.
What's your, to the degree that you still have to at least show some savvy with apples, what's your favorite thing to eat with apples in it, or what your best way to eat an apple?
There's an apple crisp recipe that my grandma would do, and it was very simple, and I think it was 4 ingredients, and I actually will do, I'll mix various types of apples in that, and you get sweet and sour.
It's a different dish every time.
It is every time.
Yeah. Any other special apple dishes on your list?
Well, we bought an old cider press that my uncle had put a electric motor on it in 1940s. Horribly unsafe thing, no
yeah.
safety features whatsoever. And so I've kind of switched to trying all the different things you can make with cider.
Ah.
And there's a lot of choices out there.
And are any of them booze related?
No, my dad got into that, but they produce so much carbonation that the bottles were exploding. So we stopped.
That seems dangerous too. Can you settle a family dispute for me?
Sure.
What's the difference between apple juice and apple cider?
Well, really, apple cider is supposed to mean hard cider.
Okay.
And somewhere along the lines in the United States, they started labeling cider on apple juice.
So non-alcoholic apple cider is the same thing as apple juice.
Yes.
Yeah. I've lost the dispute.
Sorry.
So speaking of families, will your own family carry this tradition on, do you think? You've got 4 kids, you said.
My youngest she's actually in charge of the shop now. So she sets the hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
She gives you instructions.
Yes, she sets everything up.
So there sounds like there's some potential for this.
Yes.
Well, that's Rick Godsell. He owns the Wagon Wheel Orchard. And Rick, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, maybe you will drive out of town an hour or two for an orchard. But when we come back, what restaurants are worth that kind of trip? What's a place you like that's worth making a day or half a day of it? Our food critics will be here with their road trip worthy restaurants. And we want to know yours, too. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Sometimes you just want a quick bite, sometimes you want a fancy night out, and sometimes you have a culinary craving that can only be met by getting in a car and hitting the road. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and today on KCUR Central Standard, we've got the food critics here to talk about restaurants that are not in Kansas City, but are an hour or two or three away and worth the drive. Mary Block, hello.
Good morning.
Jenny Vergara, welcome.
Good morning.
And Charles Ferruza, welcome back.
Thank you.
So we want to hear from you, too. Tell us your road trip-worthy restaurants at 816-235-2888. And do it soon, because a little later we'll be checking in on the latest news with restaurants opening, closing, making big changes here in town. Again, 235-2888 with your road trip-worthy restaurant. So let's go out of town. And Jenny, help us set some parameters here. What's the radius we're talking about that makes it acceptable to build a trip around where you will dine?
Well, I think 3 hours is probably the most I would travel, maybe for a road trip, maybe four. I mean, 4 hours would get you to St. Louis. It would get you to Tulsa.
Oh, that's on the proviso that you're spending the night after you leave.
Right. Yes, right. Of course. Okay. Yeah, no. There's a day trip, mm-hmm. and then there's a road trip. And road trip to me implies an overnight stay for sure. So I think anything less than about 3 hours is probably good.
And Mary, I have to think that the criteria for choosing a restaurant you're going to drive a couple of hours to is somewhat different than which one of the dozens of restaurants within 15 minutes I could go to.
Absolutely. I think it has to have something special that makes you want to get in the car and go, whether it's the chef or the type of cuisine, the atmosphere. Maybe you're somewhere where you can't beat the view, or like up in Weston where you have a bunch of choices and mm-hmm. you could do a little progressive style.
Yeah, the collection, the context. Charles, is there something about having to take a journey to get to the food that maybe it even enhances the experience of the food?
Well, think? Of course, you're asking the person who taking a journey to the grocery store is too much for me. I don't want to do it.
So the experience would not be an enhancement
in your
case.
There's a lot of little like roadside pit stops that you can kind of catch along the way to make that even part of the journey.
Well, actually, I've been racking my brain sitting here on that note. I don't mind driving to St. Joseph, Missouri. I think it's such a weird and fascinating
city.
It's a
beautiful town.
But what, help me, Jenny and Mary, what is the name of the famous fried chicken place? It starts with a G, Galvin's.
There you go.
It came to you.
Yeah. And I have, on occasion, taken a road trip to St. Joe just to eat at Galvin's.
Mm-hmm. So, well, let's start with some of the closer in places maybe as far as St. Joe, an hour or so. Some people even commute from these places, so they aren't exactly road trips for everyone. But Lawrence seems like a hotbed of good dining. We've sometimes talked about Lawrence restaurants on the show before. Why do you think Lawrence has such a collection of restaurants, Mary?
Undoubtedly because it's a university town. And for the most part, they're reasonable and the college budget can afford them.
Mm-hmm.
But for those of us who want to come from Kansas City, they've got a great collection.
Yeah.
And
although,
and,
Mary, I want to differ with you on college towns. I've been to many that have had horrible restaurants.
Well, there's that.
Columbia being one of them.
But yeah. I don't see many Columbia restaurants on our list.
No, but they're getting better, too.
I think, really, Lawrence has decided to start to cultivate a chef's culture. And I think it's trickling into a lot of different areas with their butcher shops and their bakeries. So I think that there is a real desire to have. There's people there certainly who want good food and not just, you know, college bar fare, if you will. So I think college has made the decision, or excuse me, Lawrence has made the decision to really be a better food town and has cultivated that chef culture, which is certainly, to me, part of what's ushering in all of these good new restaurants that are there.
So there are a bunch. Mary, what's your favorite?
You know, I would have said Hank Charcuterie, but fortunately for Kansas Cityans, Vaughn Good closed it up in Lawrence and just opened Fox and Pearl in Kansas City. I know we'll talk about that later, but I would say 1900 Barker is one of my favorite places to go. Ibis Bread here mm-hmm. kind of rivals it. It's a bakery and a cafe.
Now, Mary, you don't think 715 is high on the list?
It was going to be my next shot, but I love 1900 Barker.
But it's just a bakery, isn't it?
Yeah, but they have cafe foods,
too. And Charles, what's so great about 715?
I have never had a bad meal there. I think it's a very appealing place. I think it's a very imaginative chef. The patrons are always good looking, and that's always a plus. But no, I think it's a great restaurant, worthy of being in a much bigger, better town than Lawrence.
It was the first. I think of it as the first kind of New York style restaurant in Lawrence where you walked in and you thought you could be in a big city.
Well, and they were doing their own in-house butchering of whole animals, which was kind of unheard of really in Lawrence at that point. They had chefs that really cared about that craft. And I think they were even a little ahead of the curve bringing it to Lawrence. And I think now Lawrence has finally kind of caught up with what they're doing in terms of, you know, the animals that they use there. But it's Italian themed. If you haven't been, it's really warm, cozy, romantic. I like 715 an awful lot, and a lot of great chefs are coming out of that kitchen.
So check out 715 and 1900 Barker in Lawrence. And of course, our food critics have lots of other recommendations, all of which we will put up on our website, kcur.org, later today. But let's move across the state line and way across the state line into southern Missouri, where Springfield, Missouri comes up, and the surrounding areas, like the Ozarks too, have quite a lot of good choices, Jenny.
Yeah, you know, I went to Springfield probably about 2 years ago because there was so much going on. And part of it has to do with the fact that I write for Feast and we cover Springfield as part of our kind of area. So I had been reading some articles, but Springfield has a new hotel called Hotel Vandevort. And we actually have one of our Kansas City chefs, Travis Meeks, who's now the executive chef of that hotel. So that would definitely be where I would recommend to stay. And then there's Mother's Brewing is there. Askenoski Chocolates is there. You can go take a factory tour and sample chocolates while you're there. My favorite place in all the restaurants and bars was Golden Girl Rum Club. It's kind of a tiki-inspired bar that serves like late-night ramen bowls and kind of different bar snacks, but really cool atmosphere. That was probably the best experience I had in Springfield.
We actually have a caller at 816-235-2888. Kathy from Peculiar, Missouri. You think Springfield's a destination, I hear.
Yes, I do. We recently, my girlfriend and I, took a trip to visit Avery Cafe. I understand there's two locations. This is the only one I'm familiar with, was on Republic. It has a French-type menu. It's breakfast, brunch, and lunch. And the food is just really excellent. I enjoyed a breakfast poutine with ham and sausage and bacon and cheese, and oh, it's just terrific. I think my girlfriend had chicken and waffles, which was very tasty. The chicken was so tender and moist, it was just amazing.
So that's the Aviary Cafe, did I say that right?
Yes.
Okay.
And our destination, that's our first stop. Then we go to, as your panel member there was talking about, Askenoski Chocolate was one of our main reasons for going. If we can't go through Springfield without stopping there. And then rounding out our trip, okay, we stopped by a grocery store to pick up Bluebell ice cream. So okay, it was a wonderful location.
Well, you don't have to be in Springfield to get Bluebell ice cream, but that's good. I appreciate that. Thank you, Kathy.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
There's one more caller if we venture away from Springfield to Lake of the Ozarks. Hi, Barbara.
Hi, how are you?
Doing great. So where do you like to go when you take a road trip out of town to eat?
At the lake, I like to go to the Blue Heron. In fact, I'm on my way there for tonight.
I see some nodding heads around the table. What do you like at the Blue Heron?
I definitely like the owner. He gives you a much welcoming atmosphere. He tries to create his home country of Austria. But the food is amazing. I've had battered fried lobster in outside of America, in Kansas City, and a couple of other places, and none of them compare to what I get at the Blue Heron.
All right. Thanks for the recommendation, Barbara.
Thank you.
And Mary, you agree?
I do. And they're known for their fried lobster. And why get anything else when you're there? Because where else can you get something like that?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm on board with the whole fried lobster.
I wouldn't make a trip to go for it, but when you're there, you got to try it.
I'm
and
sure it's
I
delicious.
Enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Can
yeah.
I get it fried in on a stick? Like a good state fair food?
Anything fried can be on a stick if you really want it to be. We're talking about great road trips from Kansas City to take in meals that maybe you can't get right here in the metro. 816-235-2888 is the number to call. Let's head up north of the lake and north of Springfield up to a little town that a lot of people don't know a lot about, Arrow Rock, Missouri. Jenny, how did you even find a fine dining establishment in Arrow Rock?
So my journey to Arrow Rock started with the Lyceum Theater. They have an amazing theater group that actually recruits people from New York and Chicago, talent that they actually house in Arrow Rock over the summer to do these productions. And they're lovely. I went to go see Will Rogers' Follies, which is, I'm from Claremore, Oklahoma, home of Will Rogers. So I was there for good reasons, but we needed a place to eat. And Catalpa is the restaurant that we chose. It's a chef-driven restaurant. It's Liz Huff who's in there. And she's doing real farm-to-table. It's a house, the restaurant
itself.
Why
does Liz Huff sound familiar? Did she used to be here?
No, I don't know that she's ever cooked in Kansas City. Okay. I don't know that she's ever cooked in Kansas City. Yeah, maybe she did, but she's just doing really comforting, lovely, home-cooked food. It's kind of coursed out for you, but you have to make a reservation. It's not a terribly large place, but good. I mean, for a nice dinner before the show, it was perfect. She actually took me outside to show me her garden that she's growing in the back and her herbs and things that she's using. So
it's the kind of place you would not expect to find in the town of Arrow Rock. One cautionary note for our listeners, I believe it's only open on Friday and Saturday night. And so don't go up there on a Tuesday expecting to get in.
Yeah, and call ahead, mm-hmm. make a reservation. Mm-hmm. Remind folks where Arrow Rock is, even.
It's kind of between here and St. Louis.
I mean, but it's north of Rocheport.
Yeah, north of 70, right.
So we get off at Rocheport, mm-hmm. and head
You might get off one exit ahead, but that general area.
All right, Boonville, that whole neighborhood.
Right.
Very good. Well, Catalpa in Arrow Rock, and again, we'll put all this information up online. It is possible to go back into Kansas, go a little further than Lawrence, and find some pretty great places in Topeka. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I've got a great recommendation in Topeka. The White Linen Restaurant is open now in the historic Columbian Building. And this is it's a gorgeous red clay kind of building that is on the historic register. This young chef and his wife have gone in, and it's in a old bank vault is where he has his kitchen. So it's a very small, intimate dining room. I think it's maybe 25 seats, not much of a bar per se, so definitely make reservations. But he is doing incredible big city fine dining food in his restaurant. He is trained here in Kansas City, traveled everywhere. He did a couple stints at Alinea, spent some time there stodging, and then was offered a job and decided to come back and stay close to home and open up a place near, obviously, his family. So Topeka needs this. I mean, as the capital, it really needs a nice fine dining restaurant.
There were
sure.
years where Topeka had no place to eat except maybe the old Country Buffet.
Right, yeah. Right.
Speaking as someone who has covered Jefferson City, Old Country Buffet is still winning. 816-235-2888 with your recommendations for out-of-town dining that's worth the drive. Janice is calling from Topeka. Hello, Janice.
Hi there, and so, I am recommending Next Gen Steakhouse in Maple Hill, Kansas.
Okay, remind us where Maple Hill is, yeah.
Okay, it's about 20-30 minutes southwest of Topeka in the Flint Hills.
Okay.
Just a cozy little community right off of I-70, and it's the decoration is just great. It's like a very sophisticated cattleman's type steakhouse, and the meat it's grain fed, and it is just absolutely wonderful. And their salad is, I would go there just to get their dinner salad. So many times you get this little bowl of salad with some limp lettuce and a little piece of tomato. This is wonderful. It's a great atmosphere, and I recommend a drive out I-70, take the exit to Maple Hill, and in a couple of miles, you're there. And it's just wonderful, a wonderful steak.
Excellent. Thanks for the recommendation, Janice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're welcome.
That trigger anything from other places in Kansas there, Charles? You have a look.
Oh, I was just kind of amazed by the water in the background. I felt like I was in a feng shui nightmare.
She had a little babbling brook there, didn't she?
Yeah.
Well,
find that soothing, Charles.
I have been to that restaurant. I made a little Valentine's Day trek up into the Flint Hills and kind of did a few of the little towns around there, kind of explored the restaurants. And that was a great little stop. I mean, it's not a very big place, but it was great steak.
Maple Hill, huh?
I mean, think about it. The cows are out your window. I mean, they're in your backyard there. So, of course, it's going to be good.
If as we get further out of the area on the Missouri side, there's some great places up north of Kansas City that a lot of people talk about. And you mentioned earlier, Mary, that Weston is one of those places with a lot of options together.
There certainly are. And my favorite, I was so excited. So Green Dirt Farms is in Weston, and that's where the cheese is made. I was so excited when they opened this creamery because you can get bread sandwiches from a local bakery up in Weston with their various cheeses.
Right.
And my husband has never met a grilled cheese sandwich he didn't love, but these are just exceptional.
Yeah.
And they do great kind of pairings. You know, certain cheeses go better with bacon or tomato or onion, and it's just a fun little spot. You can buy the cheeses, of course, but you can also sample them through a sandwich.
And of course, they also have the tasting dinners at the farm itself.
At the farm itself, yeah.
There's other good places around Weston, too, that a lot of folks talk about. Jenny.
Absolutely. So I have kind of three places right now that are just in my wheelhouse. The first one is Noah's Cupboard. It's a relatively new place. Again, probably 10 seats. This chef is originally from New York City and has relocated to Weston with his lovely wife, who's from Weston. And they're opening up a really lovely... it's very farm fresh. Obviously, he's right around there to get all the good produce coming in the back door. But he's open for dinner only, I believe. He may have started lunch already. But really fresh, interesting plating, a kind of an international flair to what he's doing, but not over the top. It's not overt. Definitely make a reservation and do go to Noah's Cupboards. I'm really impressed with what they're doing there. The Vineyard is a great place if you're there for wine tasting, just to hang out, have a glass of wine. It's a little French-inspired bistro. And then Tin Kitchen has a green chili burger that I just dream about.
Where is Tin Kitchen in Weston?
Tin Kitchen is right on the main drag.
Okay.
I always tend to kind of go, there's a side street that has a side entrance that I usually end up going, but it's Main Street, Weston. You can't miss it.
Is Weston... And forgive me, my memory's not so good, but the little city that has the drugstore, that has the restaurant on the second floor, that's famous for A, pies, and B, ghosts.
Oh,
I don't know about that.
No, I don't either.
Yeah, I don't
I'd
either.
I'd love some good pie in Weston. That would be interesting.
Weston, and it looks like a little main street that should have a pie shop on it, doesn't it?
It does.
A drugstore.
And a drugstore.
Yeah, I think Weston is kind of slowly turning over again. I think there's just, you know, more and new interesting things that are moving in out there and tons of reasons to go.
And less than an hour from downtown.
That's right. Yes.
So, well, we didn't even get very far from Kansas City. We could have talked about Omaha, which I know Charles has a growing dining scene.
Yeah, very much so, and especially that downtown area. And I'm trying to remember the name of, and I'm sure one of the listeners will remember. It's a famous old steakhouse in Omaha that I believe is owned by Warren Buffett. And it's one of those old red flocked wallpaper steakhouses.
Mm.
But I had one of the best steak dinners in my life there.
Interesting.
And I'm going to make a pitch for Des Moines and for Fong's Pizza, the only combination Chinese restaurant pizza place you've ever been to. And it's amazing.
I took my son to Fong's.
I'm Crab Rangoon Pizza?
Did you put the kamikaze hat on and do the shot? That's all I want to know.
I certainly did not.
Oh.
Yeah. And after we bashed Columbia earlier in the program, we do need to include Julie on Twitter, who says, I highly recommend Flyover in Columbia. It's a wood-fired oven restaurant cocktail bar featuring excellently prepared Midwestern fare. So it sounds like she wrote this or wrote the website. Served small plate style, sharing noteworthy cocktails and excellent service.
She's right. Flyover is amazing. Columbia, it does have wonderful restaurant scene. They're growing.
All right. Well, when we come back, we'll come back to Kansas City. It's time for our quarterly check-in on restaurant news around here. Who's in? Yes, Shake Shack. Some others too. Who's out? Yes, Eden Alley. But some others too. We'll hear it all when KCUR Central Standard returns. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR Central Standard. Every few months, our food critics Charles Ferruza, Mary Block, and Jenny Vergara make sure that we're up to speed on the latest comings and goings in metro restaurants and chefs. We also welcome your questions at 816-235-2880. 88, and that's what we're doing in this last segment of our show today. You know, Eden Alley has been in the news a lot for closing. Some committed carnivores said it made them like vegetarian food, at least every once in a while. Jenny, is there more to this Eden Alley story?
You know what? They've been pretty quiet about their closing, and I think they've just been in that spot for a really, really long time. It was a nice central location, both for tourists and for locals alike. I get an awful lot of emails from people who come to Kansas City who are looking for vegan and vegetarian options, and I never hesitated to send them there because everybody knows where the plaza is. If you're coming to Kansas City, you're likely going to be there.
The nice thing is, nowadays, you can get really good vegetarian fare at almost any restaurant you go to.
Right, so you don't have to go to a vegetarian only, unless it's for some reason as a matter of principle. That's
exactly
what you want to do.
One of the things I did like about Eden Alley was it evoked Kansas City's very first vegetarian restaurant, which was at the Unity Inn on 9th Street downtown.
Ooh, wow.
The building's still there, by the way. And
Eden Alley, of course, was in the basement of the Unity Temple,
right,
on the plaza.
Right, yeah. And so it was kind of the original Unity Inn, which, by the way, in the 1900s, it was the first restaurant in Kansas City where you paid what you thought you should pay, which turned out to be a giant flop. But
everything comes full circle. Now.
Yeah, it does. And Eden Alley sort of evoked that same sort of, healthy nut-based dishes and things like that. Mm-hmm. Although I got so bored with it, I could hardly stand to eat there anymore.
Well, all right. Thanks for your honesty. We appreciate that. So, and speaking of closings, and one that I think may be universally mourned at this table, Le Monde Bakery is closed.
Oh, yeah.
Charles, what did you love about Le Monde Bakery?
Well, I loved the staff that worked there. They were so great. I thought Jeff Dover, the owner, was a great guy. I thought the pastries were always delicious. Mm-hmm. And I was thrilled when, KCUR would have them, send things over for the fun drive.
But Lamont took good care of us here at the station.
The curry chicken soup was one of the, I hope another restaurant in town picks that soup up. And also they had the most delicious spring rolls once a week.
Yeah. So I have to say, I'm really sad to see Jeff go. He's going to be spending more time with his family now. Obviously, the baker's hours are not conducive necessarily to great family life. But having said that, I mean, he has survived on that strip when North Kansas City wasn't really happening like it is now. So it's really sad for me to see someone who's doing good food and amazing breads and the great chicken curry soup leaving that spot, obviously.
We should say, though, Jeff is and Le Monde is going to continue to do the baguettes for is it Bon Fimi or Mi Bon Fong?
Bon Mi Fon.
Yeah.
And I just had one of those sandwiches, and they're so delicious. And I thought, how wonderful that Le Monde Bakery will still be doing the bread for them.
Yeah.
So a little taste of Le Monde will live on.
That's right.
Let's get the rest of the bad news out of the way, too. We only do this every few months, so there have been a few restaurants we've lost.
Well, there. I'm sad about West Bottoms Kitchen closing. They were a lovely father-daughter couple, and they had, it was lunch only, just terrific food. Their kitchen sink salad, I still crave.
Because it had everything but the kitchen sink.
Well, basically, but it had an unbelievably good sweet onion dressing. And they did a lot of Creole food, and you had ladies who lunch in there, and you had construction workers, and it was just a lovely atmosphere.
And of course, up north in Smithville, Justice Drugstore has said goodbye.
Right. So we have it on our closing list, but we should really put it on our coming soon list. Jonathan is committed to reopening Justice Drugstore, so he's looking for a place. He still maintains he's going to be up north somewhere, so we'll have to wait and see where he ends up landing.
Used to live up north, and I would say I wouldn't mind if it wasn't quite such a far drive to the Justice Drugstore.
Right.
Anything else worth mentioning that's closed in the last couple months?
Well, Fritz's Chili. Do you have a story about Fritz's, Charles?
No. Did you ever go there? On 95th Street?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That originally was a Dixon's Chili, and they branched out on their own. And I was always very, very fond of the cheeseburgers and less fond of the chili. But, it was, if you liked that kind of chili, which was kind of an oddball chili where you had to kind of dress it yourself with ketchup or onions or things like that.
Yeah, it was kind of a do-it-yourself kind of thing.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing, too, is that Brooksiders are really mourning the loss of Domo Sushi. They've closed, and so something else will be going into that location. But Brookside needs some good sushi, and they've got a couple places around there, so hopefully something good will go into that spot.
Brookside will bounce back.
Yes,
I'm
they
confident.
Will.
There's lots of new things actually opening or have opened in the last couple of months. And Charles, I want to get your take on the one that's getting a lot of attention on the plaza, the new Shake Shack.
I haven't been there yet. I'm eager to try it. I mean, what the plaza really needed was a new burger and shake place. But
a national chain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't quite dig that, but... you know, I hope they do well. The one thing the Country Club Plaza has always had since the 1930s is there's always been a good place to get a burger and a shake. I don't know that they needed one more.
Well, and, you know, Kansas City's dining scene has accelerated so much over the past decade, and we really are on a par with big cities now. But Shake Shack just gives us a little bit more cred because it's a big-time chain, and it's the one chain that all big cities have.
Right.
So.
I did my time standing in a freezing cold line in Madison Square Park in New York for 40 minutes for a hamburger and a milkshake, and it was good, but,
I think the one thing that most people will be surprised about is that it's a lot of, like, standing in line and getting it to go. There's very few tables inside a Shake Shack. I mean, you can sit and eat, but it's really a grab-and-go, so you should kind of keep that in mind if you're needing to spin out somewhere else. I think it's brilliant that they're on the plaza from a business perspective. Danny Myers is beloved in the hospitality. He's written basically the handbook for our industry. So I think all of us want to give props for that, but we can't forget, obviously, that we have our own homegrown hamburger spots that are just as good. So go to Shake Shack, stand in line, get your Insta on, and then head to a local place too while you're at it.
One of the local places that's opened is Fox and Pearl. And Mary, you mentioned the chef came from Lawrence.
Yes. So Hank Vaughn, that's not right. Vaughn Good. I'm looking at this thinking, no, that's not right.
I've called him Hank many times.
Yeah. Vaughn Good was in Lawrence at Hank's Charcuterie, and he's opening a new place on Summit. It's not done yet. And so rather than, spin his wheels for a long time, he's temporarily popped up in the old novel space at 17th and Summit. And he's opened for just in the past few days, he opened for dinner, and this weekend he'll be serving brunch for the first time.
Mary, is he going to do, in Lawrence he was doing a fried chicken night. Is he going to do that here in town?
I don't know.
Okay.
It all comes back to fried chicken, though.
Yeah, it always does, yeah.
But he's just so talented, and as the original name implied with charcuterie, he does a lot of nose-to-tail type food, but done in very creative ways. He's not going to just put a piece of meat on the plate.
I was in there recently for dinner. It was really good. Lots of handmade pastas, a pork chop that you just cannot not eat. It's just absolutely fabulous. And, nice little wine list, great little cocktail list. It's a nice alternative to having Vaughn Good in our lives. So I'm glad he's going to go through the holidays making a little cash.
Love that you can just do a pop-up restaurant.
Amen.
If you have those talents, you can make that happen.
Brian, can I put a shout-out to a new Waldo Thai place?
Yeah, please.
If only because I had this incredible sense of deja vu walking into that new restaurant. Because I'm pretty sure, maybe one of our callers can tell us, I'm almost positive that that location was where, in the 1980s, there was a very popular Egyptian restaurant called Cafe Nile.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it had wonderful food and lots of cream sauces that I could actually eat then.
Mm-hmm. And then Swagger with really good French fries. Just have to say that.
Oh, my gosh, their burgers were as big as your head.
Yeah.
But speaking of Waldo Thai Place, the Thai Place, the new one opening in Waldo, that's
open,
big...
and it's very sleek and very attractive. And they had a more complicated menu than I remember from any of the other Thai Place restaurants.
I agree. It's more upscale, and I think the menu is much more exciting, and the execution is fabulous.
Well, and this is the same people who had Westport Thai Place. And so they're now out in Waldo in a little bit of a smaller space. And the husband and wife have kind of switched roles. And she's now in the kitchen, Pam. And she is doing really interesting, lovely regional. It's a small list. Don't go in there looking for pad thai. I mean, it's really interesting.
No. They do have pad thai. They do have pad thai.
One small pad thai.
You know what they had that was so delicious?
Don't waste your time on that. Go to the big stuff.
Go for something you haven't had before.
They had short ribs.
Beef short ribs on the menu.
And a hoisin brisket.
Yeah.
It was delicious. Mm-hmm.
Whole fried fish turned on its side. Daryl Liu is the bartender there. He's doing amazing cocktails. So there's a whole bunch of reasons. They have that great garage door, too, that they flip open in the front, let the fresh air in. Lovely.
And another new offering in a new genre, I think, actually, which perhaps we could call a boozy bookstore, Our Daily Nada. What is that?
Our Daily Nada is two lovely ladies who have opened up on Delaware Street in the River Market, this new bookstore slash cafe slash coffee shop slash cocktail bar. And it's a really great place where you can go in, shop for books, meet a friend, have a bite to eat, grab
a
cocktail.
Mm-hmm. That was a nice segue.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. So the chef from The Bite is the one who they consulted with to do the menu there. And it's just a classy little...
Which building is it in, Jenny?
It's a couple doors down from the farmhouse, basically kind of in the middle between Tribe and Farmhouse, just kind of in the middle of that strip. But it's adorable. And if you love books and you want to just cozy up with a cup of coffee or a glass of wine and kind of see what your next new favorite book is going to be, that's the place to go.
And there's another one opening soon, right,
yes,
Mary?
Yes. Afterward, Tavern and Shells will have the same concept, maybe a little heavier on the cocktails.
So that's opening soon. That's
yes.
That's in Crossroads, right?
Yes.
Yeah. While we're back up in River Market, there's been a whole flurry of new restaurants opening in that little couple block area of Delaware Street.
Yeah, Delaware's so hot right now. So Freestyle Poke opened up there, which is serving poke bowls. I believe we've talked about them before on this show. Still deserves a shout out. You have to go in there and get some. They're doing a really nice job.
In the name of research, I've made several visits.
Yes.
And I'll be submitting those expense reports soon.
Yes, good. It's and, you know, healthy and good for you, so that's good.
Yeah, and speaking of healthy, a kitty corner across the street.
The new Betty Ray's ice cream, obviously, has opened up, and it's their second location. And I have to tell you, I just drove on my way to Waldo Thai this weekend. I passed Betty Ray's, and we were like, what's that line?
Uh-huh.
They are still lining up in Waldo, even with a second location open. So clearly these folks needed a new location. But the River Market location is same song, second verse. It's pretty much the same. You can find all the same stuff, but delicious, fabulous ice cream. If you haven't stood in line, go to the River Market location.
Another opening, Mary, I know you mentioned, is the new restaurant at 1900 on Shawnee Mission Parkway there.
Yes. People think of it as a, you know, an office building, but they have event spaces in the basement, and then adjacent to the parking lot in the back is this lovely restaurant called Restaurant at 1900. And
is that the one where Linda Doerr is the chef?
Yes. So they've got Linda Doerr as the chef, Keith Goldman, who used to be at the American, and Corvino as the general manager.
Rock stars.
Andy McCormick, who used to be at the American, and Corvino, is the sous chef. Doug Frost, never...
Master of wine.
Right. He's not usually associated with a restaurant, but he is, and he's doing the wine list.
Mary, is Janet Ross there?
No.
Okay.
Mm-mm. She's at the Russell.
Okay.
Anyway, the food is just lovely. Really, everything is just a treat to eat, and you can actually carry on a conversation. Mm-hmm. It's really
no loud music.
No, and it's carpeted, so you've got great acoustics. And the other thing I should say is we were meeting some people for dinner, and they put 1900 or whatever in the GPS. They ended up at Michael Smith, which is 1900 Main. And I love Michael Smith's restaurant, but just be aware, those are two different places.
There's so much more we could be covering, but I don't want to miss out on the things that are coming soon either. Quickly, what's one highlight you'll be watching for the next couple of months, Mary?
The huge Parlor Food Hall has to get a shout out because it's going to have six restaurants within it and a bar. And Jenny has been in there. You could probably say more about it.
You guys aren't going to believe this place. I mean, they've taken an old brick building down in the Crossroads. It's near Thou Mayest, and it's near Grinders, and it's going to have they've done a beautiful job on the rehab. It's whimsical, but it's fun. It's just the right size. You can land and have lunch, dinner, drinks, hang out with your friends. A little bit of an outdoor patio, which is great, which has an interesting view of the skyline. But they have hand-selected some really amazing chefs in this town who are going to be bringing us very interesting ethnic choices. So do be looking for Parlor to open soon.
I've been to these food halls in other cities, and they're kind of amazing.
Can I say, is Plaza 3, the steakhouse, the restaurant that will not die? I mean, come on.
I know. They're supposedly going to be opening back up out south.
But Pigwich and Local Pig in the City Market,
amen.
Shout out to them. They're
shout
moving from the East Bottoms.
Well, we will track all of this news, the openings, the closings, and the coming soons, all on our website, kcur.org. Again, that'll be up later today. I want to thank our food critics, as always, Mary Block, who blogs about food at Around the Block, Jenny Vergara, who joins us from Feast Magazine, and freelance writer Charles Ferruza. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll have the list up at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. Don't forget, this conversation can continue all day, or in fact, in perpetuity, on social media. Follow KCUR on Facebook or our show on Twitter. We're at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Kathleen Pointer, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher makes us sound good every day. And our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Gina Kaufman is back next week. I'm Brian Ellison. Have a great weekend.